This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, Jerry Seppos. He has some thoughts about the newspaper war that continues to evolve between the Advocate and the Picayune. John Georges took over the Advocate 15 months ago, and he's moved into New Orleans and Lafayette with a vengeance. How's that going? We'll discuss it with Jerry Seppos. Also on the show, a major conference regarding Parkinson's disease coming at Pennington Center, and we have Alan Cutter, who is a Parkinson's survivor and a local minister. He will talk about his experience with a disease that afflicts far too many people. And the elusive former 30-game winner, the last man to win 30 games in a Major League season, Dennis Dale McClain. He should be with us for a few minutes as well. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your local number, and outside the area it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with the fabled pitcher Dennis Dale McClain. He won 31 games in 1968 with the Detroit Tigers, winning the Cy Young and Most Valuable Player awards in the American League at the age of 24, and a year later he won the Cy Young again, winning 24 games for the Tigers in 69. He's had an amazing life, and he is one of our favorite guests. Good morning, Denny McClain.
Good morning, Jimmy. How you doing, pal?
Doing well. Good to talk with the man, the myth, and the legend.
And
a former radio network owner. You owned the Michigan Radio Network for a brief period.
Yeah, I did that for a while, and then I did radio in Detroit for many years and television, and all of that was great, although it was a lot of fun. And I was there when the big transition was going on, when all of a sudden, three, four, five companies were buying every station in the country. And to say the least, the industry changed in that moment. And, we decided that that wasn't the direction that we wanted to stay in. So, we started doing other crazy things. So, but nothing crazier than radio and TV. You know that, and I know that.
Well, and you've always had the ability to talk. Your mouth was as fast as your fastball, and Denny.
Well, God bless me being an Irish Catholic. Number one, number two, God bless me with three, four, or five things. You blessed me with number one, great, great wife. Number two, great children, great grandchildren. You gave me great control when I was healthy. Pretty good fastball, and lo and behold, the ability to BS and talk and. And I do a lot of reading, too. I mean, so it just isn't off the cuff. So, you try to stay informed. You try to, listen. You know what the job is. You got to know what's going on in the world all the time.
Well, some know, but others don't. You're the son-in-law of one of the great players in the history of the game, a Hall of Famer.
I am. Lou Boudreau. In fact, I'm in Cleveland. I was in Cleveland last night. I'm in Cleveland again today for luncheon, having a great time. And, he is everywhere you look here. There's a Lou Boudreau street, Lou Boudreau sign. It's really nice to come into a city where your father-in-law is honored, and the adulation is overwhelming.
And you met him long before you became the man, the myth, and the legend.
Well, I met him at a, we won a state baseball championship in Illinois, and we got home back to Harvey, Illinois from Mattoon, Illinois, which is about 3.5 hours, in those days, 4 hours from there to Harvey, Illinois, just south of Chicago. And he was the MC. So that was the first time about 1 o'clock in the morning I met him, and I had met him. There was this young lady about my age at the time, 15 years old, that was standing next to him. And I don't know if it's hormones or just sexual. Unbelievable. I mean, I just went head over heels for her, and I said, "Hi, I'm Denny McClain." She says, "Oh, that's nice. What do you want?" And now, 50 years later, we're married. So those must have been the magic words.
Yeah, and your career took off relatively fast. By the time you were 19, you were in the majors. And you spent 10 years there, and 10 of the most interesting years anybody's ever had. And the game has changed, and a story last week, which prompted my call, and I always enjoy talking with you about any number of things, but in 2007, Alex Rodriguez was allowed to take testosterone through the whole season by the commissioner's office. How in the world does something like this happen?
Well, I don't know. You know, different rules for different folks, different strokes. I mean, I just don't know. This, but what irritates me about it is that, you know, the conversation always falls to Alex Rodriguez. Listen, there's 104 guys we know that tested positive for all kinds of illegal drugs. Read Canseco's book. He named every one of them. A bunch of guys came out and said, listen, he's lying, he's this, he's that, and this and every other thing. Everybody threatened to sue him. Not one of those people he accused ever filed a lawsuit. Not one. Yes, he's been kind of banished from the game, from the players, but you know what? He did a big thing for the game of baseball. I don't know if he'll ever recognize it, but he's the one that brought it up to the point that the commissioner's office had to do something about it. He did a, you know, I don't know if he knew what he was about to do. I don't think he understood what the hell he was going to catch and how incredibly negative it was going to be. But you know what? Baseball started to clean itself up. And I think at this point in time, the game has never been cleaner since the late 80s. Listen, people don't understand. This stuff has been around since the 80s, folks. Start looking at the stats in the middle, late 80s. Look at the home runs they started hitting, early 90s. This wasn't just a magic pill that appeared in the early 2000s. This was there for a long time. And baseball players, because of all of their wealth and all of their ability, can constantly keep coming up with new formulas for this stuff because they can pay college kids and with chemistry degrees. They can go to pharmacists with chemistry. I mean, listen, money speaks. We all know that. And a few extra bucks in somebody's pocket who's not doing well will go a long way.
Denny McClain, a man who pitched in the 1960s and early 70s. And in your day, amphetamines were rather prevalent, weren't they?
You know what? No. I always take a little exception to that. Listen, the 60s were no different than the 50s or the 70s or 80s. We didn't have the big enhancement drugs that they finally wound up with, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, and into the 2000s. But what we had was cortisone. Folks, don't overlook the fact that we were shot with cortisone. If you come in one day with a headache, you got a cortisone shot. If you had an ankle injury, you got a cortisone shot. If your butt hurt, you got a cortisone shot. And then they would give you a choice. And this is how rampant it was at one time. And we didn't know what the hell they were. Very few of us, I think, ever really took them. But they had a white pill and a green pill and a blue pill and a red pill. And they would say, listen, this one is for this. This one is for this. If you take two of these, this will happen. If you take three of these, this will happen. I suspect one of those, possibly, but they were known as greenies. They were not very strong, and this is not to defend the practice. Don't misunderstand me. But I think there were 5 milligrams. So I think you had to take zillions of them to really get going with the alleged speed that they caused. The only guy I ever saw take a lot of them was a couple players on our team, Norm Cash, which we talk about in one of our books, and one or two other guys. But, you know, Norm was the guy who, and a couple other guys on the team, they enjoyed, you know, not only playing baseball during the day, but they enjoyed playing baseball at night, wherever they could find a game in a casino or in a bar or someplace. They enjoyed that game at night. And in order for them to play the next day, they'd sleep all day. And then the next thing you would know, bottom line, was, you know, they get to the clubhouse, they look a little hungover, mm-hmm. and by the time game time rolled around, man, they were ready to rush through walls. Right. And it was, but I suspect there was a whole lot more at times than speed. You know, it is what it is. But he was the exception. He was not the norm of the game then. I don't think we were educated well enough in our education, okay, whether it was high school or college, that we understood what we were doing back then. I really don't.
So Norm was the exception, not the norm.
Yeah, it was certainly the exception with the amount. Not only that, but, you know, think about Babe Ruth hitting 61 home runs. Did he take any drugs? All I know about Babe Ruth is he hit 61 home runs.
60.
Lo and behold, he ate 15 hot dogs a day. I mean, maybe there's a correlation there.
Well, Doc Ellis, and this is an inquiry from a listener, he claims he threw a no-hitter in 1970 on LSD. He did walk 8 guys and hit 2. Do you believe it?
I don't believe the story. I've never believed the story. Listen, if you're that high, I mean, I don't think I've ever been that high. But if allegedly what he says, I mean, I known a lot of people in my life, ball players, football players, basketball players, and other folks, and just in the normal walk of life, that have been on that stuff in the 60s, especially the 60s. You know, everybody says, once you take it, you're in la-la land. You're not thinking sanely. You're not thinking thoughtfully. You have no plan. Your plan has been destroyed. And bottom line is, you can't function. There's no way. I mean, you know what that was? That was to sell a book. It was a great story to sell a book.
All right.
And he may have had some drug problems at the time. I don't think there's probably any question about that. But to go out there and say you loaded up with LSD, hell, you wouldn't know who to pitch to. Mm-hmm. Would you pitch to the shortstop, the third baseman, or the hitter?
Well, he did wear number 17.
Yeah, I know. He had a great number. So,
he told a great story. He said that the 90, he threw the no-hitter, and he says he was on LSD. The whole game, he thought Richard Nixon was the umpire.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Dr. Pam Monroe at Louisiana State University says, I'm a huge baseball devotee, but only just now read Jim Boughton's Ball 4. I'm trying to place it in its historical context. Curious to see or hear Denny McClain's take on Ball 4. That was during your time. What did you think of that? That was groundbreaking stuff at the time.
Well, it was to some degree. It was very funny. It was humorous. I think most of the players took it in a humorous way, with the exception of Mantle. Mickey got very, very upset about it because Billy Martin would chide him all the time about, there's somebody said about you this time, Mickey. Look what he did this time. Look what he did. And that was what was wrong with Billy. Billy caused Mickey's demise a lot sooner than what it should have been. But the bottom line was, listen, it was a very entertaining book. Jim is a very funny guy. Every once in a while we run across him. And he's still an entertaining guy. He still is receiving the rewards of Ball 4. Look at us. We're talking about it this morning. If anybody wants to read the first real funny book on baseball with lifestyles, I mean, they talk about Mickey Mantle going on top of the hotel in Washington, D.C. with binoculars and looking into the hotel rooms trying to find women undressed. Now, I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, people will do crazy things when they have a couple of cocktails, and Mickey had more than a few cocktails after a ball game. But the bottom line, I guarantee you, it wasn't Mickey's idea. I'll guarantee you it was Billy Martin's idea, and Billy Martin was holding the binoculars so Mickey could see.
Who was the biggest character you played with or against?
Oh, Norm Cash. I don't think there's any question. Norman could go 24/7. Yeah, Norman could balls to the wall all the time. He was just one of those kinds of guys. And unfortunately, I guess the lifestyle led to the disaster that he had in his life. He had a stroke and then mm-hmm. suffered with that stroke for years and years and years, and apparently suffered another stroke in a rainstorm going to his boat in Upper Michigan and fell and got killed, hit his head on a deck or something, they say. So, that booze in the amount that Norman took, and Norman just absolutely would not accept the fact that he had a stroke. He had some paralyzation, and he wouldn't accept it. He still tried to live his life the way he had lived it the previous 45 years. And unfortunately, he couldn't walk the appropriate way. He couldn't drive really the best way. So he was just a car crash waiting to happen, of course, in a rainstorm on a boat deck. It happened to him in the middle of the night.
46 years now since 1968, and Detroit was quite a place then. And, of course, it's still a great baseball town. I see where Verlander, who is struggling, he has 8 wins, but he's making $20 million this season. He's great, but not as great as you were in 68 and 69. How much would you have earned today?
I have no idea. I mean, I can tell you this, that in my entire career, my 10-year career, I made $440,000. That's 10 years. 10 years, that's how much I made. I mean, it's kind of incredulous when you think, because we're the guys who walked out in 1971. We're the guys that walked out and went on strike. We're the guys that demanded some free agency. We're the guys that demanded an increase every year in the cost of living. And if the truth be known, they could have probably put off free agency another 20 years had they just accepted the cost of living increase every year. But the owners went up in arms. You mean to tell me we got to give them a 4 or 5% increase? I was one of the assistant player reps.
Well, Denny, we got to roll. But thank you. Good luck in Cleveland, and talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day, folks.
Take care. And we shall return with Dean Jerry Seppos. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and we're speaking with a man who knows a little bit and maybe a lot about most things, Jerry Seppos, 3 years now the dean of the LSU School of Mass Communication. He has an essay in the latest issue of the Business Report, The Future of Print, which coincides with the Business Report's cover story, John George's Big Gamble. But he was listening with some interest to Denny McClain, and you're a big baseball fan in your day, weren't you?
I was a Washington Senators fan. I remember where I was when I heard that Calvin Griffith was moving the team to Minneapolis.
My goodness, that goes back to the early 60s.
It does, right.
Yeah, and he took Harmon Killebrew with him.
He did, and years later, when I was editor of the San Jose Mercury News, I got a chance to have lunch with Harmon, who was a car dealer at the time.
Yeah, and that brings us to an observation from Hugh at LSU. Do you remember the Salk shots? You remember who that was? The four sluggers for the Senators. We had what? Killebrew was the K.
We had Bobby Allison.
That was the A. Sievers? Sievers?
Roy Sievers.
And who was Bob Lemon? Who was the?
Yeah, I think you might be right. And you know something? I think I have all of them on an autographed ball at home here in Baton Rouge.
I'd be wrong about the L. We got to find out who the L
right.
was. But they had some sluggers, and of course, baseball has returned to the nation's capital, and it's appropriate that the national pastime is in the nation's capital. And one of the old pastimes of people through the years, I remember as a kid, the first thing I started reading in newspapers, box scores. And they're still there. And you can learn a lot about mathematics if you follow baseball. But the future of print is, as you write in your essay in the Business Report, Dean Seppos, it's cloudy. We don't know what's going on, do we?
We don't, and I think box scores are a perfect illustration of that. In seconds, we can look up box scores for any game that we want, even if it just ended moments ago, thanks to the internet. In the olden days, we had to wait for the morning newspaper, or I actually remember at my father's grocery store being very excited when the sporting news would arrive because it had all the box scores.
That's right. And I remember in the Sunday paper, they'd have all the statistics from the American and National Leagues.
Right.
They don't do that anymore.
Right, there's not a need to because there are so many other ways to get it. Which
oh, there's a need.
There might be.
But,
some of us are some of us are emotional about it, but not many of us.
Some of us are purists,
right?
But, and there's nothing like having that paper in front of you. Like right now, we've got a lot of papers in this studio, and we've got the current edition of the Business Report. We're not looking at it online. We're old school, but there aren't a lot of us are still around, are there? And what happens when people like us die away?
Well, the most telling statistic is that newspaper circulation has been declining for 50 years.
50.
50 years.
And this was long before the internet.
It actually started in the early 70s, right after I got into the business, so the decline. And in fact, in 1972 was the height of newspaper circulation. It's been downhill ever since, despite a growing population, obviously. So that tells you a lot right there.
Well, Dean Seppos worked with Knight Ritter for 33 years. He is not only an academician of note, but he did the job. He was in the trenches. And journalism is evolving, as is the rest of the world, but journalism in a very big way. And we are right on the cutting edge of what's happening with newspapers. And whether John George's bought the Advocate to satisfy his ego or whatever the motivation was, he has sparked, I think, something good, a newspaper war. This may be the only place in America where we have one.
Yeah, I think it is, and it's wonderful for readers. It truly is. I'll quibble with your term, newspaper war. I actually think in the book, mm-hmm. we call it a news war because it's being fought on several fronts, print, the internet to some extent, and really TV with both the Times-Picayune and the Advocate shooting their own video, and both of them having alliances with New Orleans TV stations.
Well, the essay from Jerry Seppos is part of a book called News Evolution or Revolution, The Future of Print Journalism in the Digital Age. It's going to be out and about next month, and it also has work from Amy Reynolds and Andrea Miller, Associate Deans at the Manship School and they edited the book, and we have this war of sorts going on with John Georges flexing his muscles not only in Baton Rouge, but he's gone into New Orleans and to Lafayette. You note that other newspapers have tried this without much success. Why would he be different than, say, the Los Angeles Times, which tried to move south many years ago and had disastrous results?
Yeah, I can't answer that question, and I think we're not going to know for a while whether he is different. What we do know is that history teaches us that even back in the pre-internet days, it is tough for a newspaper to go to another city. And the reason is very clear. A good newspaper like The Advocate or The Times-Picayune is the ultimate local product. So by definition, importing it to another city is a tough thing to do. If it were generic, vanilla, and didn't have anything about a community, then it would be easy to do, but nobody would want to read it. But if it has a lot of local news, it's tough to make it local in more than one location.
But in George's case, one advantage he has as far as New Orleans is that the Picayune has cut back to 3 days a week as far as local delivery. Does that potentially open a hole in the offensive line for Mr. George's?
Well, as you said earlier, none of us knows what the future is going to bring, but I'm one of the few journalists who thought that the Times-Picayune might not have a bad idea by going to publication just a few days a week. I know that's heresy for a journalist to say, but if you're looking to cut your expenses and to put out a good product, a very good product, a few days a week, I think it could work. And I'll bet you 10 years from now that many, many newspapers are published only a few days a week, or maybe only one day a week, Sunday.
Not at all.
Or maybe not at all.
Maybe all online.
Could be.
Could be. And at some point that could be the case. But will we always have a national newspaper? Right now we have a few that are hanging in there. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today. They're still going.
They're still going, but I think the fundamentals are the same. And I don't see what's going to keep them alive any more than anybody else. It is a very tough business. As I said, a 50-year circulation decline. I mean, that's astounding. And just in the last 8 years or so, advertising is down a third in U.S. newspapers. It's tough out there. It really is.
Well, the newspapers not only are printing less, and there are fewer of them, but there's less content. So, and people are paying more for less content.
Right.
How long can that cycle continue?
I don't think it can when you look at the other way of getting news, or one of the other ways, the internet, where there is unlimited content. Now, all of it may not be brilliant, but there's unlimited content, largely free. So you got a collision happening here, clearly.
Well, it will be an interesting evolution. And The Advocate right now, as Stephanie Regal points out in her story in the Business Report, daily in Baton Rouge, Monday through Friday, 53,138 subscribers as of March 31st, and on Sunday, 65,602. How do those numbers compare? That would mean that about 1 out of 10 people in Baton Rouge subscribes on Sunday to the Advocate. Is that comparable to what's going on around the country?
It depends on the city, and actually Baton Rouge's penetration. That's an industry word for the number of papers delivered versus the population. The Advocate's penetration is good. But again, if you have a 50-year trend, you've really got to worry about the future.
What's it like now for reporters in the newspaper world? There's uncertainty, but is it still a viable option for somebody who wants to spend a career reporting for a local newspaper?
It's absolutely a viable option if, and we tell our students this, if you know how to report on every platform. So I would like our students, if possible, to learn how to write for the internet, to learn how to do things on the internet that help readers understand data. I'd like our students to learn how to dig into data. I'd like them to learn how to shoot video. You know, the common terminology is that these digital natives understand video. Well, our broadcast friends can tell us that that video doesn't come naturally to everybody. We spend a lot of time teaching it. So I think if they know how to work on every platform, there's no job that's more fun than reporting the news.
297-5633, your number, if you'd like to join the conversation with Dean Jerry Sepos of the LSU School of Mass Communication. As mentioned, he worked 33 years in the newspaper trenches with Knight Ridder. There were some vivid experiences for you during those years, I'm sure.
There were indeed a lot of fun.
Unlike Denny McClain, who said a few guys were popping amphetamines, journalists usually use old-fashioned pharmaceuticals to keep going, right?
That is correct. And as I was getting into the business, that was still happening. Happens a lot less now.
Smoke all over newsrooms, right?
All over newsrooms. I remember people complaining when we made the San Jose newsroom smoke cigarette-free in, I guess, the early 80s, something like that.
Yeah, and some writers were known to have a drink or two at their desks.
They were indeed. I actually never saw it in the newsroom itself, so that tells you the change right around the time I got into the business. I saw it outside of the newsroom a good bit. Mm-hmm.
Well, John Georges is quoted in Stephanie's story in the business report as saying, printing costs, circulation, advertising, that doesn't matter. The bigger issue is, did we clear the beach at Normandy? Yeah, pretty much. Now, I think we need a translator. Would you like to translate John Georges' statement?
Well, I won't presume to speak for John. But the first part of that statement, printing costs, circulation, advertising, that doesn't matter, is truly an exceptional statement. Because almost every other publisher in the country worries about all those things. And if John is able to support the advocate, as he told me that he is able to, through his other businesses, that is quite remarkable. He says that there's a line of credit available, but that the company does not have debt as of now. Most newspaper companies are bogged down with incredibly heavy interest payments. If he doesn't have that and doesn't have to worry about day-to-day expenses, that's quite remarkable.
All right, 297-5633 is your number. And a listener, ironically, another Jerry, asks about the Advocate hiring away some of the Picayune's personnel, some columnists in particular, James Gill, Stephanie Grace. Does that really matter in the overall scheme of things? Do people buy newspapers based on who's writing editorial columns?
There's a great debate about that, and I hate to say it, but I think probably the overall quality of the newspaper matters less than individual bylines do. It hurts me to say that, but I'm not sure that you would find too many people who say, I buy the Advocate because of James Gill. On the other hand, I think it's a nice part of the whole package to have James Gill there, but very few people could name a single Advocate or Times-Picayune byline.
Well, John Georges, according to his then spokesperson, John Hill, spent $11 million running for governor in 2007. He spent a few million more running for mayor of New Orleans thereafter. He's spending $1.7 million to renovate a former car dealership, turn dance hall at 840 St. Charles Avenue into offices for the New Orleans Advocate. There are reports, which he denies, that say he spent $50 million to purchase the Baton Rouge Advocate at the same time that the Boston Globe was sold for, I think, $70 million, which has about five times the subscribers as the Baton Rouge Advocate. Did he pay more than he had to? What do you think? Was this a good deal for the manships?
You know, we all pay if we go out to buy a car. If we want the car enough, we're going to overpay for it. And I think it's very hard to say what a newspaper's worth to an individual. If he really wanted it, there was only one Advocate on the market.
And he is the type of person who, as he has stated, apparently can lose money on this, for the satisfaction of being a publishing titan, and have other businesses sustain it.
Right, and that's part of what makes the news wars, as we call it, so interesting, because the Newhouse family, which owns the Times-Picayune, is one of America's most wealthy families. And while it very much runs its properties as a business and wants them to turn a profit, It's a little hard to imagine two more deep-pocketed sets of people facing mm-hmm. each other. There are amazing resources there on both sides, and that's why it's so fabulous for readers. I just revel in the amount of news that I can get every day.
John Georges, who's been on this show a few times before he bought The Advocate, and is a very charming individual, and hopefully we'll have him back, but his company, Imperial Trading, has made its fortune on gambling and drinking and smoking and the so-called sins, and yet The Advocate is housed in the offices owned by one Jimmy Lee Swaggart, the nation's foremost, perhaps the world's foremost, televangelist. What an irony this is. Only in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jerry Seppos, could we have such an irony.
It's pretty amazing. I've told that story to some of my friends elsewhere, and it's quite remarkable. You're right.
And The Advocate, and I'm not going to ask you to delve into this because I don't know what the motivation is, but it's kind of curious. There's never a story about Brother Swaggart and The Advocate. You'll never see a story about Jimmy Swaggart, and that's a major, major story going on, the comeback of Jimmy Swaggart from evangelical oblivion to where he is now is remarkable. At the age of 78, he has... He's done a remarkable thing, and I'm sure he takes great satisfaction in having The Advocate as one of his tenants. And I bet John George's checks each month don't bounce either.
I'm pretty sure they're good.
But will they move out of that building at some point? Will they move the whole shebang to New Orleans?
I don't think so, because I think John realizes that The Advocate, as the editor of the Business Report wrote in a separate column in this issue, all of us don't think of The Advocate as a business. We think of it as an institution in Baton Rouge, and it really is, and it's so important to the community. I'd be very surprised if the whole shebang ever moved to New Orleans.
But right now, it is uncertain in Baton Rouge, and John Georges has invested heavily in New Orleans, and according to Stephanie Regal's report, Monday through Friday in New Orleans and Lafayette combined, The Advocate has 30,287 subscribers and 30,959 on Sunday. Considering the investment, is that a respectable number?
Well, the number sounds fine, but you have to think who is the number important to? And the number is most important to potential advertisers. And what I'd like to know, and we may learn this when audited circulation figures come out in the fall, I'd like to know where that 30,000 is. If 29,000 of it is in New Orleans, which I very much doubt, that's a good start. And an advertiser might say, gee, that's enough concentration of readers that I'm interested. If 29,000 is instead in Lafayette, I'd say the Gannett newspaper there, which is doing some good things also, probably has to worry. It's the concentration of readers that matters more than the raw number. If the 30,000 are spread out over 100 miles, doesn't make any difference at all.
Jerry Seppos, the dean of the LSU School of Mass Communication the past 3 years, will be with us for a few more moments, and then we'll hear about a major conference pertaining to Parkinson's disease at our home base, Pennington Center. 297-5633 or inkstershow@wrkf.org. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Jerry Seppos, the dean of the LSU School of Mass Communication. What about transparency in journalism today? Do we have government entities becoming more and more protective of what they feel is not available for the public domain?
Absolutely, but it's ironic because at the same time, there's so much information that's online that we're able to learn lots of things the government doesn't want us to. But yeah, the Obama administration in particular has been a real foe of transparency.
And another question from a listener. Carolyn asks about the move yesterday by the Picayune to pull out of the Louisiana Press Association. What's going on with this?
That was quite exceptional, a little bit of inside baseball, but quite exceptional. I'm not sure that I've ever heard of a newspaper pulling out of its own trade association. It's quite remarkable. And the reason is that the Times-Picayune and The Advocate were fighting over legal notices. Those are ads that public entities have to put in saying that a divorce is about to happen or that there's unclaimed property or whatever. And they've been fighting over those. Usually there's never much of a fight over them. And the Times-Picayune was unhappy that the LPA didn't stand up for it. I imagine the Press Association was in a very tough spot because two of its members were squabbling over these ads. But quite remarkable. You know what it really tells you is that these two sets of people don't like each other very much, the Times-Picayune and Advocate People. They won't tell you that, but all you have to do is look at what happened yesterday.
Well, sometimes feuds are good things. maybe the journalists who work at these entities may benefit from that feud of sorts.
That's entirely possible, and as I said earlier, I know the readers are benefiting.
All right. What was the resolution about these? These public notices, by the way, are big money for newspapers. So what was the final resolution on that?
Well, I should say that both sides have told me that they don't make a lot of money from them, and I've never sat down and put pencil to paper to figure it out.
They make money or it wouldn't be a big issue.
They certainly make money, no question. The resolution is that the Advocate is indeed getting legal notices from a few municipalities that used to advertise only with the Times-Picayune. The battle is still on. Only a few municipalities have made their decisions right now.
297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Jerry Seppos, Dean of the LSU School of Mass Communication for the past 3 years. Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Jim and Dean Seppos. It's a wonderful program, and you mentioned about legal notices. I'm interested in your comment about births. I can remember when babies were born and the birth would be in the newspaper. Now, of course, it's Facebook. When our daughter had her second child, didn't even send out notices anymore. Oh, Dad, it's already on Facebook. Implications for the future?
Oh, implications for the future are that We've probably, as a business, forgotten some of the things that are important to people. Somewhere in my boxes, in my move from the West Coast, is what you just said, a laminated clipping from the San Jose Mercury News with my daughter's birth listed. So, that you know, it's still important to readers. It's not important to those of us in the industry anymore. Mm-hmm. And that may tell you why we're in a decline. Very, very good point.
Well, President Obama actually proved his birth in Hawaii by the newspaper notice. Now, some people believe that maybe he was the chosen one, and they just put that in there in August of 1961 to make the case 40-some years later, but or 50-some years later, but it would seem unlikely. But the social media has changed, and how do you, as the dean of one of the finest journalism schools in America, how do you instruct students about the evolving nature of the journalism business, if you will?
We try to teach them every platform, as we say, every way to deliver news and other information. And in fact, we're building a social media lab now, and we're going to teach them how to track. If they want to see what the world is saying about LSU, we will we'll show them how to do that. And we've just hired as a visiting professor for a year the most prominent person in social media and journalism in the country, Steve Buttrey, who started this week.
And where did Steve come from?
Steve was from Digital First Media, sort of a holding company of about 75 newspapers that's done more with social media than anybody else has.
Well, you got a good one there, and you've had some remarkable people in the journalism vineyards who have toiled at LSU, and the school is doing well, but you have to feed the beast. I imagine a big part of your operation is raising money.
It is indeed, but it's also a fun part because alums in particular are so fond of what they learned at the school.
One more question for Dean Seppos from Dominic in Grand Coteau. Good morning, Dominic.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've been in the newspaper business like 36 years now, and I do appreciate the comment about the births. I think somewhere along the line, newspapers forgot about the brick and mortar of what the people want. But at the same time, I think the issues that they're facing now is they're letting technology wag the dog. Instead of making it work for them, we're jumping through hoops left and right, and I think it's going to filter out eventually, but right now it's just kind of a crazy time in the business. That's my comment.
All right. And I think Dean Sepos is nodding in agreement.
Well, I was chuckling because that caller spent exactly as much time in the newspaper business as I have. I would say if he's criticizing distribution by digital means, I think he's probably wrong, because I think digital is, alas, a better way to distribute news and other information than dead trees are. But we'll see. We'll see how it works out.
Well, let's hope there's still some dead trees out
yes.
there. But one Michelle asks, says another listener has been waiting patiently, so we'll slide Kathy and Lafayette in at the finish line with Dean Sepos. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'd like to know what the dean thinks about, in the UK, they're ruling about the climate change, since there was 97% to 98% of scientists who do believe in climate change, them not giving equal time to the 1% or 2% who believe that climate change does not exist.
Yeah, the toughest thing to teach is not technology or numbers or any of that. It's what makes a fair story. And I think a lot of us were taught, Jim, I don't know about you, when you were at LSU's School of Mass Communication, but I know when I went to journalism school, I was taught to balance the sides out.
Well, I think that one's getting some balance. Certainly on radio, if you listen to people like Rush Limbaugh.
Indeed, and I think one real problem for journalism is that false equivalency, as they say. And I think we've got to teach students somehow to figure out when there is an equivalency and when there's not.
Well, one of the ironies is that Rupert Murdoch's made a fortune abroad and in the United States by poking into people's private lives and going to great lengths to do that, as we found out. And yet I read in Vanity Fair that his last marriage was broken up by one Tony Blair. And I haven't read that in the Wall Street Journal or any of Rupert Murdoch's publications. Are there certain areas where some of these reporters, you know, these intrepid reporters might say, you know, I better not go there?
Well, it all depends on the publication and who's in charge of it. I'd say the journal does a pretty good job, but reporting on your boss's peccadilloes is always a hard thing to do.
That's not a good thing, and I doubt that the Advocate will be doing any investigative work on the personal life of John Georges, although I hear he is quite the family man. I doubt that he has anything in his background that rivals that of Mr. Murdoch.
Hardly.
Thank you, Jerry Sepos.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate it. We're joined now by Alan Cutter. He's a local retired Presbyterian minister and a disabled veteran, president of the International Conference of War Veteran Ministers, and he is also a Parkinson's patient. Good morning to you, Reverend Cutter.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. Yes, indeed, I do have Parkinson's disease. I was diagnosed in June of 2010.
So 4 years.
4 years. When I went into the VA clinic here in Baton Rouge once, I happened to be sitting with the patient advocate, and I held up my hand that was shaking uncontrollably, and I said, should I be concerned about this?
Is that generally the telltale sign?
There are four big signs. One is tremor that occurs in your legs or your arms or something like that. Then there's rigidity, stiffness. That's the second big sign. The third one is slowness of movement. And the fourth one is really loss of balance. I had three of the four. I couldn't walk down a hallway without running into a wall.
Well, you seem to be doing okay right now. How were you able to get back on your feet?
Thanks to the neurologist I was going to, the medications that I take, they allow me to function pretty well. However, I found it necessary to retire from the ministry, and I retired a little bit early, because I could not count on my body to support me in the work that I was doing.
We're visiting with Reverend Alan Cutter, who is a Parkinson's disease survivor, if you will, and there is a major conference coming at the Pennington Center this week, and we will talk with him about that. But this, unfortunately, is a disease that does not get better over time.
It is a chronic and progressive disease. When I was first diagnosed, I was taking minimal medications. Over the 4 years, slowly but surely, my medications have increased. And I'm really been very fortunate to have a good care and a good wife who understands the problems that I face and is willing to put up with some of the strange things that I sometimes do. I'm really looking forward to this third annual Parkinson's Conference because it has just been a wonderful cooperation between the Pennington Biomedical Research Center and the Neuromedical Center and the two support groups for Parkinson's disease that are here in Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. the Thursday afternoon Blue Bonnet group every third Thursday and the fourth Saturday Movers and Shakers, which meets at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Those two support groups and those two organizations together about 4 years ago began to talk about having this kind of a conference. And here we are at the third annual conference, and it promises to be the best one of the three because they've learned with each one what works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it's been just a real adventure to see the progression of the conference. July 19th is going to be a wonderful day for the people with Parkinson's disease in our area. And I hope that many of people have already pre-registered on the Pennington site.
As far as the cause, and that's a question from a listener, Terry, the cause of Parkinson's, is it known? Is it what do we know about what triggers Parkinson's disease?
The cause of Parkinson's is not really known. It is known that what occurs is that there is a lack of cell function in the brain to produce dopamine. Dopamine is the chemical that controls movement. Parkinson's is, at its heart, a movement disorder. But it can be caused by a variety of things that nobody really knows about. My Parkinson's is attributed to exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam.
That's what did it.
That's when we went through the process of diagnosis, they came up that this was it. Now, you know, Parkinson's is diagnosed by what I call observation, elimination, and experimentation. They observe you to see if you have any of the symptoms. I had three of the four, plus a couple of the minor ones. We went through the process of elimination, a brain scan to make sure there was no tumor, a history to make sure that it wasn't any kind of imbalance, chemical imbalance. And then the third part was experimentation. You take a drug for Parkinson's. If it works, you have Parkinson's disease.
Mm. How many people have it?
Here in the United States, it's estimated over 1 million people have it, and 60,000 people a year are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
So if 1 million people in the United States have Parkinson's, that would mean Louisiana would have about 20,000 people.
20, 30,000 people, I would imagine.
And prognosis, unfortunately, is that after about 10 years, most people are unable to get around in the conventional way.
It can be progressively debilitating. I have found over the last 4 years that I'm slower moving, I'm more rigid. It sort of focuses your mind pretty much on what the future holds and how you want to live your life right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the event organizer at Pennington is Dr. Don Ingram. I'm sure you're familiar
Yes.
with him. And he is somebody who knows quite a bit about Parkinson's. For those who'd like to register,
they can go to the Pennington research site. It's important to pre-register because we need to know how many people are going to be there because it's a free conference and lunch is provided through the generosity of several organizations. So we really need to know by July 14th who is going to come and attend.
All right. And Alicia Prather has noted that in Louisiana, this is another unfortunate statistic. We have one of the highest rates of Parkinson's in the country, and we have more than 60,000 people believed to have Parkinson's in Louisiana, so way above the proportional number nationally.
I would not be surprised at all with the high incidence of the various industries up and down the river, and also with the high incidence of men and women who come from the South, from Louisiana, to serve in the military. And have been exposed not only to Agent Orange, but other various chemicals over the years. And now the whole business of traumatic brain injury is opening up new questions about the causes of Parkinson's.
Online registration is still available, and it is a major event, July the 19th, at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, the third annual Parkinson's Conference. Thank you, Reverend Cutter. And certainly you provided some important information to us. And for Michelle Southern, I'm Jim Engster. We thank you for listening. Back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.